Welcome to Same Surgeon, Different Life, part of the STS Surgical Hot Topics podcast. This series focuses on demystifying cardiothoracic surgery and presenting the remarkable backstories of surgeons from a variety of backgrounds and in various career stages that have led them to become the face of CT surgery. I'm Dr. David Tom Cook, and in each episode, Dr. Tom Varghese and I will get to know more about our colleagues, the obstacles, the success stories, trade-offs, and pivotal moments that have shaped their careers as well as their personal missions. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. The program will return after a message from our sponsor.
The Society of Thoracic Surgeons Same Surgeon, Different Light podcast is sponsored by AstraZeneca, celebrating 25 years of creating innovative medicines and improving access to them.
Welcome to Same Surgeon, Different Light, a podcast from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Workforce and Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. In this episode, we have the privilege of speaking with enterprising young surgeons, Dr. Angelica Martin and Dr. Lillian Tsai. Dr. Martin is an integrated resident at the UC Davis Health in thoracic surgery, and Dr. Tsai is an independent traditional fellow at Stanford Medical Center. Join us as we explore their unique journeys to becoming cardiothoracic surgeons. Dr. Martin, Dr. Tsai, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you mind if I call you Lillian and Angelica?
Of course.
Great. Of course. And you could call me David. Angelica, this is probably the first time in your career that you ever call me David. So
I don't know if I will be comfortable doing that, but I appreciate the gesture.
And the reason why I bring this up is Angelica is an integrated resident at UC Davis Health, which where I am on faculty. Well, thank you for both of you for joining us today. I really felt this was a good opportunity for us to learn about you and learn about cardiothoracic training. With that, let's start off. Angelica, what is an integrated resident?
An integrated resident is someone who has decided that cardiothoracic surgery is for them. And from the get-go, they know that that is the goal. So they go through an extensive 6-year to 8-year training that has a little bit of general surgery in the beginning to serve as the foundation, and then more extensively focuses on cardiac and thoracic surgery throughout the next 5 to 6 years.
Great. So it's kind of like when someone goes from medical school to and match directly into general surgery.
Yeah, so you match directly into cardiothoracic surgery, so you don't have to apply for a fellowship position.
Great. And so Lillian, what is an independent fellow?
An independent fellow is someone who has finished their general surgery training. So that's 5 clinical years plus however many years of research, and then applies for a fellowship and does a 2 to 3 year fellowship subsequently.
Great. And did you think about I6 residency?
I thought about it, but when I was starting general surgery training, I wasn't completely sure what specialty I wanted to do, and so thought that general surgery would give me the broadest view and training towards all different types of specialties, and then I would have the chance to explore and make a decision a little bit later on.
Great. So, you know, it's interesting that you thought about cardiothoracic surgery, but not quite there. And then Angelica, it seems like you kind of made up your mind early, or how did that happen?
I did. I was thinking about going into family medicine, coming into medical school, and then was told to keep an open mind and to shadow around. I was told to look at surgery because I had a surgeon's personality, and I didn't know whether to be offended or not by that, but I'm very good at taking advice.
What does that mean, a surgeon's personality?
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. I think what they meant to say was that I was very mature and determined and was able to make quick decisions and just analyze a lot of different factors at once. But that's my optimistic viewpoint instead of the more perfectionist tendencies that a lot of surgeons tend to have, which are needed in the field. That's how I ended up in finding cardiothoracic surgery early, first year of med school.
And then and you went to med school where?
At UC Davis.
UC Davis. Mm-hmm. And Lillian, you were surrounded by cardiothoracic surgeons at, where you did your general surgery residency. One of which was probably at some point during your time there was your department chair, Bob Higgins, who was a subject of our podcast earlier in the past, president of the STS. Did Bob or some of the other folks there influence your decision to go into cardiothoracic surgery?
Yes, definitely. So when I was a medical student, I was at Emory for medical school. Actually first became interested when I was working with Vinod Thorani at Emory and did quite a good deal of research with him when I was a medical student. And he was really the first one who got me interested in the specialty. And then at Hopkins, Dr. Higgins was our chair there for almost the entirety of my residency, actually. And then obviously a lot of other amazing cardiothoracic surgeons there who all really influenced my choice. I did enter residency thinking more cardiac and then kind of changed my mind to thoracic, in large part because of the faculty there, Dr. Steve Yang, Dr. Bada Ferrano.
So, I think we like to name drop on this podcast, and it's not a coincidence because a lot of the names that pop up are people who are really involved in education at different levels. So whether it's medical, graduate medical education or undergraduate medical education, i.e. medical school. But tell me about the value of mentorship. And what do you, when I say the word mentorship, and especially as it comes to you all's careers, what does that mean and what did it look for you? You know, Angelica, maybe you could start off.
Sure. I come from an underserved community. I'm the first in my family to go to college and even medical school, graduate school. So it's kind of like navigating this career path on your own. So your mentor is your North Star. You try and find as many of them. And I think a mentor to me is someone who is very generous with their time and their advice, who are willing to really be honest and truthful about what it takes to get to the next step and also just share the resources. So it's difficult to find a place to start if someone isn't really clear and honest with you. So I've had a lot of people like that have helped me get to where I am. So Dr. Godoy from UC Davis is actually the first person that allowed me in an OR. I had no idea he was a CT surgeon, and I just thought that it was really cool that he was a surgeon, but that really started my path into surgery.
Dr. Godoy is a member of our SDS Workforce for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Lillian, how about you? What does mentorship mean to you?
I think mentorship in general is probably one of the most important, if not most important, things in many medical students and residents deciding on a specialty or a career path. And I'd say a lot of the same things that were already said. I think one thing is being generous with time, really investing in your mentees and their careers and would kind of propel them forward in the future. And I think another thing that's important is to have mentors that you want to emulate or want to be like, and picking up different skills or characteristics or things like that from them.
Yeah. So when we look at the current trainees within cardiothoracic surgery, say we just combine independent pathway, the traditional fellowship, and the integrated pathway direct to residency from medical school, we're about 20% women within the training pathway. If you look at American Board of Thoracic Surgery certificate holders, it's obviously less than that. You know, there's a statement that I hear a lot, and I have personal opinions on it. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on it. You can't do what you can't see, right? What pops into your head when I say that? Angelica, you're kind of laughing there.
Well, I think I know you a little too well, so I knew that phrase was coming up, that's the phrase you were talking about. But I think that there's just, you know, there's different types of individuals with different personalities. Some of them need an extra little push that might be a visual representation of what they could achieve. Others might be able to visualize a future that, you know, might not yet exist. So just like there's different stages of change in, you know, human behavior theory and all of that, I think that the same applies to individual personalities. Some people just need a little bit of extra help than others. But I've never, when you are a Latina and you are female, you really don't have anyone in medicine that looks like you very much. So you kind of have to force yourself to visualize yourself in any field, or you can cling on to the few that do exist. So different personalities will need different things, but I think that, but that statement is valid for some.
You know, Lillian, you have Jennifer Lawton, at Hopkins, Betty Tong is a Hopkins grad, and you're at Stanford, with Leah Backus and others. Has that transition as a woman in cardiothoracic surgery been an easy transition for you, or does general surgery kind of help prepare you for your environment?
I would say that definitely I've been very lucky in that I've had many female mentors. I did 2 research years with Dr. Colson, and she was an amazing research mentor. And I think just like you mentioned, both at Hopkins and at Stanford, there have been many women who have been excellent mentors to me. But I do kind of echo what you said before, was that I don't think you necessarily, I think it's always wonderful, and perhaps some people it is an added benefit, but I do also think that the many men who have mentored me have been just as good mentors as the women. And I think as long as someone is invested in you and really wants you to succeed and can help you through that, I think men are just as valuable as women mentors have been for me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Angelica, you had talked about importance of, I think you described it as Spanish speaking individuals and Latinas in healthcare, that there's not a whole lot of representation per se. But we have talked about, you know, potentially cross-cultural demographics in regards to mentorship. Do we really need, Does our cardiothoracic surgical workforce really need to reflect our communities? I mean, California, 30% of our population is Hispanic Latino. Is that even realistic?
I think it is. I am very optimistic about the workforce that is upcoming. I look around and, you know, even just the UC Davis residency program, 4 of us are women out of 6. And I have many mentees who are now interested in cardiothoracic surgery, who are currently applying, who are Latinas as well. We just formed the Latino Coalition, the Latino CT Surgery interest group as well. So there is a growing interest. And I think that it's necessary because you have strength when it comes to diversity. You have different viewpoints that are brought in that can actually create better health outcomes for our patients. Something as simple as understanding that your patient reacts better when certain information is coming from an authority figure, meaning a doctor with a white coat versus, unfortunately, just someone in scrubs. So all of that those are little clues and cues that can really make a huge difference in a post-esophagectomy patient that, you know, keeps calling every night because they keep throwing up. And having that understanding comes from a lot of the time lived experiences, but also I share, you know, those thoughts with my colleagues. I share, you know, my experiences with my colleagues, and I say, well, maybe we should try it this way. And that creates better healthcare for our patients in general, especially when a lot of them are Latinos and have a similar background as my own.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's wonderful. You know, we look at med schools, and it's med schools are, what are they, 51% women nationally, or at least 50% women. Colleges, undergraduate schools are definitely over 50% women. And if we recruit only men in a specialty, then we will longitudinally have a brain drain in our specialty. We will lack innovation and ideas. That getting that gender diversity within our specialty seems like a natural progression, even from a selfish standpoint, getting the best and the brightest who are coming out of med school. But Lillian, I think you were there, probably not that involved because it's a different department. But when you look at the most recent match for Stanford Department of Surgery, which I think in the categorical group was almost all women, except for one man. You know, social media is not everything. And whenever someone says, I'm getting hit on my socials, I just tell them, well, just turn off your phone, right? What does it matter? Is hit on the socials, is that not a thing? Is that, did I just make that up? Or is that, it's not hip. Am I dating myself?
You can make it a thing.
I can make it a thing. Okay, that's the power of podcast. We're just gonna, that'll be the next SDS podcast, hit me on my social. But it created a firestorm. And the only firestorm was the fact that all the majority of the matched categoricals were women. What were the discussions on the Stanford campus amongst the trainees when that firestorm happened?
I wasn't here yet. I just started. So when the match happened, it was when I was still in Baltimore. But I have worked with several of the trainees who were part of that class. They're my interns now, actually. And they've all been excellent. And I think that it really shouldn't matter, you know, what race you are, what gender you are in the match process. And so I think a lot of people here probably were affected by that and the social media discourse, but I don't personally know what that was like because I hadn't arrived here yet.
Yeah. You know, recently the Supreme Court made a decision about affirmative action in recruitment in higher education, specifically undergraduate universities and medical schools. Residency is different because residency is workforce, so that has different federal regulations in regards to practice and hiring. But I've always kind of joked with some of my friends and colleagues because, you know, the state of California hasn't had affirmative action in University of California system since the early 90s. I've always joked with some of my friends and colleagues that actually maybe the Supreme Court decision was a good thing because people could stop blaming me for their mediocre child not getting into the college of their choice. Does that kind of ring true when you hear people complain about a match class being mostly women when many match classes in surgery have been mostly, if not entirely, men for 50, 70 years?
There's whole programs. There's whole I-6 programs that are only men currently. And once again, I think that, you know, the recent study that came out that showed that patients do better when their surgeons are female. I mean, that also shows that diversity is needed. We can all learn from one another. And I don't think that it really matters what sex or gender you identify as.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about sort of the environment that you all have entered. Lillian, you did your general surgery residency on the East Coast, grew up in the Potomac, Maryland area, so mid-Atlantic, and now a little bit of a stop in Atlanta for medical school, but still that's East Coast state of Georgia. And then hopped on a plane all the way as almost as far west as somebody could get and not, you know, eat macadamia nuts in Hawaii. How does one develop a welcoming environment for a new trainee where they have a sense of belonging and presence of where they should be?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. there's an I6 residency, obviously, at Stanford, as well as a traditional fellowship. And I think one thing that's really important for programs is to make sure that the relationship between the I6 residency and the fellows is a good one, and that it's kind of welcoming and has room for both. And I think Stanford does an awesome job of that. The I6 residents have been wonderful to me as a new trainee coming in. And I think also the attendings have been awesome in terms of welcoming me and kind of putting me up to speed with all how things work over here and things like that. So it's really been a really smooth and wonderful transition. I've really loved it here so far.
Angelica, your environment, you had a little bit of advantage, right? Because you're in training at the same place where you did your medical school. But as we know, we have microcultures and microenvironments. And so just because you trained at a site doesn't mean that the place where you do your residency is as welcoming or as your place where you did your medical school.
Yeah, I think, well, it was very important to me that I would be treated like an adult, given appropriate responsibility and also just allowed to grow in my residency. And that means making mistakes along the way, being corrected when those mistakes are made. I am always very open to being taught by anyone, including people outside of my surgical specialty. And I realized that Davis specifically, the attendings are all, and this is of course including you, Dr. Cook, the attendings are all really good at giving you enough space to sort of maybe make a mistake, but being there to stop you from making the mistake or being there to correct you when you make that mistake. And I thought that that environment was, number one, necessary, as coming straight from med school, I am learning how to be a doctor first and foremost, and I'm also learning how to be a surgeon, and then I'm learning how to be a CT surgeon. So all of that, I realized I would have to build up to it. So having that little flexibility was extremely important to me. And I feel like Davis specifically, the attendings allow you to do that. And even the OR staff, I mean, they all kind of correct me, you know, holding specific tools, specific ways. And maybe I was pulling too hard and they like tap me on my hand to tell me, hey, don't pull too hard. And I really appreciate that. So I'm so happy that I actually found that.
Lillian, you come from the Potomac area of the of Maryland. Angelica, you come from Echo Park. In Southern California. Where is Echo Park?
Echo Park is right in downtown LA. It's right next to Dodger Stadium. So the big commotion about the new trade for the Dodgers is everything that all my friends are talking about.
Oh, who's that? Shohei Ohtani?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. And then I think he's deferring $680 million.
A lot of money, more than I will ever see in my life, if you guess.
Yeah, which is, that's like three LVADs, right? three LVADs and two doses of pembrolizumab. That's Shohei Ohtani's salary for his career with the LA Dodgers. So, you know, I have a friend who I went to medical school with, and they once texted me on my phone and while I was here in my office in Sacramento and saying, hey, I'm flying into San Diego. Do you want to go get lunch? So people don't understand the distance that California is. And then with that, there's sort of cultural differences. There's a Northern California culture and a Southern California culture. What are some of the things that you've noticed different between Southern California and Northern California?
The traffic. That is the number one thing. Also, I'm definitely an LA driver, and the driving in Sacramento scares me. But I really appreciate the growth that I'm seeing in Sacramento. It's like we are both growing together. Me as, you know, a doctor, and the city as a bigger city. So I feel like Sacramento is definitely more laid back than LA. But it's changing a lot for sure.
Yeah. And then what about the sort of the community needs that you've seen? So LA, large Hispanic Latino community, Sacramento area, does have a bit of a Latino Hispanic community, African American, and then a lot of Asian groups that are underserved as well. LA, big academic medical centers surrounded by these communities, UC Davis as well. What are some of the similarities, differences, and what do you feel are the responsibility that you have as a trainee, if any?
I was actually surprised how diverse Sacramento is. I know that we got the biggest Afghani, Pakistani refugee populations here a couple years ago. And the medical school itself is pretty aware of the immigrating communities because of our student-run clinics. Our student-run clinics offer free healthcare resources and services to a lot of the communities that are underserved and don't have access to physicians. In LA, it's very much different neighborhoods that you'll have concentrations of these communities because they all immigrate to where they know someone. They immigrate to where the jobs are. And how are they going to get the jobs? They get it through their cousin, their friend, their friend's friend. So in LA, it's bigger communities. In Sacramento, it's more mixed. In terms of the responsibilities of the healthcare systems, I mean, our healthcare systems that are through the UC system are funded through our taxpaying dollars. So in essence, they are, you know, a public good, and they should provide healthcare access to a lot of these communities that rely on Medi-Cal, for example. Unfortunately, what I've seen being in the health policy world is that the institutions tend to sometimes not accept Medi-Cal insurance, which is unfortunate given the fact that they are have a social responsibility and a public responsibility to provide that. And I think as a trainee, I once again, the reason why I went into medicine was to be a doctor who actually looks like the community, is going to work with the community, can speak to the community and be there for them at the scariest moment of their life when, you know, they need surgery, they need heart surgery, they need lung surgery. So I think that it's my responsibility to make sure that I'm not the only one. I can't take this on by myself. And I think that that's why mentorship and making sure that there's policy level changes is so important to me, because if I don't do it, if, you know, my generation, the current generation in healthcare doesn't do it, then it's just going to stay the same. And we're not going to have the physicians that we need. We're not going to have the physicians who have diverse types of thinking to solve the problems that we're currently seeing, to be creative about how we approach, you know, someone who needs a heart transplant but doesn't have the resources for it or the family support for it because, you know, they immigrated here by themselves, et cetera. I just believe that everyone deserves to live with dignity and that we all as people in this society have the responsibility to actually make that happen.
And, you know, we can have that dual sort of responsibility for our communities and ourselves, we also have to pace ourselves too, because, you know, Lillian, there's a responsibility to, it's almost a selfish responsibility that you have to get trained up and get your technical skill sets before you can take that knowledge to restore the health of your communities. You know, Lillian, you did residency at Hopkins, which is in Baltimore. And Hopkins is really smack dab in the middle of Baltimore, which has, you know, really well chronicled issues with social determinants of health. Baltimore is a really unique city. I actually like Baltimore.
Me too.
I've been there multiple times. You get crab cakes, you got Old Bay Spice, a lot of stuff going on. And then you go to Palo Alto, which is different than Baltimore. How was that transition, and how did that sort of resonate with you in regards to the patient population that you're learning from?
Yeah, just as you said, I love Baltimore. It really has been my home for many years now. There is obviously a large underserved African-American population there. There's a lot of trauma, which as a general surgery resident, we saw every day, like many, many gunshot wounds, many penetrating traumas. And that was a large proportion of the patient population that we took care of on our trauma ACS service. And obviously Palo Alto is very different. One thing that's interesting that I've noticed is, as you kind of alluded to, in California, there's a much larger Asian population. I do speak Mandarin, which I used very rarely in Baltimore. But since I moved here, it's a lot of my patients actually speak Chinese. And so it's been very useful, I think, both in terms of communication. And I can tell a lot of the times when I speak Chinese to my patients, they're immediately kind of at more ease, more comfortable. They feel like they can communicate better. So that's been really striking for me as well.
Yeah, yeah. And do you find that the language needs are cared for in the way our healthcare structure is set up?
I think it's difficult because obviously you have kind of the translators on the iPads and the phones and definitely in person when you need it, but it's a little bit inconvenient, first of all. And I think second of all, it's just difficult to translate sometimes in a medical setting, especially if you're using an electronic means that's not in person. And so I think that really having a doctor who speaks your language makes a world of a difference in communication and patient trust.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm a monoglot, so I'm always grabbing the Marty, the traveling iPad that we could get translators on at a moment's notice. You know, in higher education, again, you all are trainees, or and so technically your workforce, but still your learners nonetheless. We have this whole concept of first gen, so first generation college, or we've gone to first generation med school, which is kind of interesting in itself. Angelica, I know you are identified for that first gen group in regards to college. Is there any advantages to being sort of first generation everything, or is it all challenge?
Well, I just want to say that we didn't go to first gen med school. That's not a thing.
No, well, yeah, not really. No.
No, that's not a thing.
First gen astrophysics, that's not a thing.
No, first gen PhD, that's not a thing.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so, not like hitting my socials, right? That's not
that fetch isn't gonna happen this time.
Oh, okay, all right. That's another podcast.
I think there a lot of the times when we talk about first gen, it is about the challenges that we face in terms of finding a way forward, finding out what the next step is. And for me, a lot of it was economically, when you don't have a safety net, when you don't have you know, someone who could pay your bills if you don't find a way to make money, that's also a struggle for first gen students. But I think that I also try to stay positive in terms of what first gen means to me. And to me, it allowed me to dream big. I mean, if you don't have anyone who's gone to college or med school or, you know, law school, whatever it is, then that means that you can do whatever you want. You can go ahead and get as many degrees as you want to get. You will struggle to get there and you will need extra help. But I try to stay positive in terms of the strength that it gives me, because if you think about all the challenges that it comes with, it can be easy to just become very depressed thinking about it and just let that be a barrier to actually achieving your goals or even setting goals and dreams that actually scare you and that maybe some people think that you can't achieve.
Now, Lillian, your parents, were they in healthcare?
No, my parents grew up in China and Taiwan, and they moved to the U.S. To come to college for the U.S. And then they met here. I was actually, interestingly enough, born in Beijing kind of by accident, because my parents were there visiting my grandparents, and my mom was pregnant at the time, and they had some...
Your mom knew she was pregnant, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It wasn't a complete accident.
No, but right. She knew she was pregnant, but traveled back and had some sort of visa issues at the time. So then got stuck there. So I was born there and then kind of came back over to the US when I was a month or two old. So did grow up my whole life over here, but my parents moved over kind of for education.
So yeah, I think we have lots of conversations about the immigrant experience, right? And which is a tale as old as time in our great country, right? And the American dream. We have a lot of conversations about first generation college people who were born in the United States, but who are born in socioeconomic status that makes it challenging to achieve our goals, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't have conversations about people specifically like the two of you who are in cardiothoracic training, who will excel in cardiothoracic training and become excellent cardiothoracic surgeons, and then are all of a sudden part of the 2% economic bracket of our country, mm-hmm. right? And if you decide to grow a family, your children are in that 2% economic bracket as well. Do you still have credibility with your surrounding communities in that sense, right? You know, as when I was a kid, you know, I always fought against the man. And then, you know, every level of my career fought against the man. And then one day I looked around and realized I was the man, right? You all are going to be in a similar situation. You all are like the LeBron James of your specialty. Sure, you may have started from modest beginnings, but the point B is in no way modest. How does that affect your view of your own career arc? And does it affect your ability to relate to communities in need, especially in need of your expertise? And don't jump all in at once. Angelica,
I've thought about this a lot, you know, especially with being the first in my family and all of that. And it really does affect you in a way when you go back to your community and you you know, catch up with old friends from high school, or people that you just went to high school with, or catch up with your neighbors and all of that, because you really can't relate to their struggles as much anymore. Because I, even as a, you know, when I first started working after graduate school, I made more than my mom ever did in a year in about 2 to 3 months. And when that first paycheck hit and I saw how much I was making and I knew how much my mom was making when growing up, it really hit me like, oh, wow. Okay. So I'm different now. But I think that what's been most important to me is that I never lose touch with where I came from and, you know, my values, which grew from my environment, which grew from interacting with the people that I grew up with. So in a way, I've stayed grounded by serving on the board of a community health center, by staying in touch with, you know, my friends from high school and middle school. And at the same time, I do feel that little gap in between being able to relate to some of the experiences that they're going through. But I also come with a lot of privilege now. So when, you know, my sister was having surgery, now I can speak the language of medicine. And now I can make sure that her care is, you know, great, and that she can actually make it through the surgery well, and her post-op care and all of that. So I don't take my privilege lightly. I actually feel it a lot, but I think what's most important to me and how I make sure that I can still relate to my patients and don't ever stray from my community, because that's important to me, is by reminding myself of my values all the time, reminding myself of where I come from by giving back, by interacting, by serving on boards, by volunteering, by speaking to pre-meds who are in the same position that I was in. And I think that if I always keep that connection, that I can minimize that gap of where I started and, you know, where I currently am and will keep going, because I didn't choose CT surgery for the salary. I honestly still don't really know what the salary is. I just wanted a challenge, and I like the field, and I wanted to make a difference with what I saw needed to be changed. But it's more about the people for me and the values of the individuals that I interact with.
Yeah, so staying grounded in the peoples and the values. You know, Lillian, from a, you know, immigrant perspective, is there a LeBron James effect or a challenge that you have to, that you feel you may have to deal with, or is that overthinking it?
Yeah, I think I agree with what you both have been saying. I think one thing that we kind of touched on before is kind of being a role model for other people in your community, and that if someone else can kind of see you and see, oh, that's doable or that's achievable, that can also kind of bring everyone else up to speed too.
And what are your thoughts about being a woman in this space, right? And I think you probably have, you know, both of you have advantages, right? Because there are women leaders in your space. Angelica, your department chair is a woman. Lillian, you know, your direct mentors are national leaders within the STS. But, you know, in our society as a whole, there's not a lot of women around who are going to have your complex technical expertise, income bracket, and respect. And we may say, laugh that off and say, you know, that's not a thing, but I'm not a woman. I don't have a woman's perspective. Is that something you think about, or is that something that that you will have to deal with as your success continues?
I would imagine so. I think that I've been lucky in my training thus far that it hasn't really felt like a barrier for me in any way, and hasn't really, I think, affected my training. I think that at least I would like to think and hope that in my training, whether or not I'm a woman or a man doesn't really make a difference. I'm trying to become a cardiothoracic surgeon, and that's kind of the first and foremost thing. And in residency, I was trying to become a general surgeon. And I think that was what took priority rather than my gender. And I'd like to think that that would be the case for anyone, but obviously don't know what other people's experiences have been like with that.
I think for me, it's definitely my identity is a little bit more complex, because not only am I a small in stature woman, I'm only 5'2". But I'm also Latina. So that means that when I walk around the hospital, I make sure to have my jacket on that says Angelica Martin, MD, MPH on it. Because then, you know, they don't question why I'm in the unit or anything like that. It hasn't affected me in terms of being a strict barrier in any sense, because I think my program director put it best that I've always been kind of the underdog in all situations. And to me, it's just proving myself time and time again. That's basically the story of my life. So I expect to do that in the field of surgery, in the field of medicine. It's kind of unfortunate that I have to do it at a greater extent, and that I have to wear that white coat when I walk around, or I have to wear that jacket with, you know, my name embroidered on it. But at this point, it's kind of second nature to me. And I think you have to be very confident and self-assured in the fact that you belong in the place, you can do the job, and you can do an excellent job at it in order to actually take up the space that you deserve. And I think part of that attitude also came from the fact that I went to an all-women's college. So I definitely learned that in undergrad. So it's never really been a strict barrier for me.
Yeah, that's right. Both of your undergrads were connected by a bus, right? Harvard and Wellesley.
Yeah.
Together. So, you know, we're getting close to the end here. And I was going to say back nine, but, you know, half our audience wouldn't know what that meant. The question I want to ask is, because it's such a hot topic going on now, is unionization of training, of graduate medical education. Lillian, I don't know, is Stanford unionized?
Yes, Stanford is.
And Angelica, UC Davis just became unionized.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on unionization of graduate medical education? Does it mean that you take a pipe and hit the kneecaps of your interns, or what does that mean in regards to unionization?
I think it's a really hard question and controversial thing, especially in medicine and in surgery in particular, because I think that our field is really more than just a job. And I think that you have a responsibility to your patients and to the general public to like really be excellent at what you're learning. And I think one of the premises of being in a union is like saying that you could quit or saying that you could strike or things like that, which I think is a tough thing in medicine and surgery, because I don't fully know whether or not that's kind of an ethical balance. And so I think it's difficult. I haven't quite made my mind up about what I personally think about unionization in general yet, but I see the pros and cons, and I see why it's a tough thing, particularly in medical training.
So Angelica, in your previous iterations, you've worked in the political space in Southern California, and I imagine you rolled up your sleeves and worked with unions for endorsements of your candidate. How does that relate to you and your view of unions, specifically in the healthcare space, specifically in the MDDO space?
Mm-hmm. So when I was executive director of a health policy, health advocacy nonprofit, one of our partners was actually a union of nurses in California and nationwide as well. And I think that in terms of having a voice for the workers, meaning the residents, I am pro-union. I think that, you know, training has been very difficult for the generations before us. And I think that sometimes you need cohesiveness to actually make a change. And unions, whether or not they achieve that, depends on their environment, depends on who the leaders are, depends on the vision of the leaders. So what I learned more than anything is that the management of the union, the management of or the voice of the people who they are representing matters a lot and what they ask for. But lots of great things can come from unions for both patients and for trainees and for even administrators. I mean, you have happier workers who are able to do better work and can be more restful, less errors. So I think more than anything, that's brought about positive changes. I just think that a lot of individuals have different viewpoints in terms of what a union is and how it should be run and what it should ask for. And that comes from either A, not knowing how a union works and what a union should look like for residents, or B, being afraid of not knowing what the future will look like in terms of having to negotiate with adults who are trying to do their job and trying to be trained to be the best possible physicians and surgeons for their patients.
What do you think faculty, attendings, administration are worried about seeing their graduate medical trainees unionize? Because there's a lot of hand-wringing, consternation out there. The residents are unionizing the residents. It's almost like Marlon Brando on the waterfront, right? What are we so afraid of?
Well, I think most of it is the trainees being able to say no. The trainees being able to say, I'm tired and I've been here over, you know, 80 hours a week and I need sleep. Or the trainee saying, hey, I can't afford my rent because the rent prices are increasing. And unfortunately, I think that the conversation is being shaped to be trainees versus attendings instead of trainees and attendings versus the institution. or the actual policies in place that dictate the changes that the trainees and even the attendings want to see. So I think that sometimes the conversation is being manipulated, as, you know, having the trainees and the attendings going toe-to-toe for things that they're asking for. But I think if you sit down and really think about it, that most people will want residents who are able to be high-functioning, able to live close by in an area by the hospital where they can actually show up if there's an emergency, are able to eat. There's, you know, some programs that don't offer a meal plan for their residents, and residents really are skipping meals. So something as simple as that, I'm sure the attendings agree that that's a necessity and absolutely within the rights of residents to be asking for. But I think that sometimes administration will want to change who the two people fighting are.
So, you know, fun fact, you know, I was a fellow cardiothoracic fellow 100 years ago at University of Michigan, and we were unionized as fellows at University of Michigan, as you might expect, the state of Michigan. I just have to say that our union fees were much less than the union fees that you two pay. I suspect, a little bit shocked by that. So I want to close up, and I think it's going to be interesting getting each of your perspectives as you're in different places in your training. You know, Lillian, you're digital surgery and you're doing a fellowship. Angelica, integrated straight out of medical school. But it's clearly that despite the different levels in graduate medical education, the two of you have vast lived experiences outside of surgery and cardiothoracic surgery. Lillian, from your perspective, where is CT going? What is the future of cardiothoracic surgery?
I think it's a tough question. I think especially for me, because I'm sort of just coming into it as a new fellow. And so I'm still learning kind of the lay of the land and everything that's developing and all the new therapies. But I know that there's a lot of research going on. There's a lot of clinical trials, both in cardiac and in thoracic. I think it would depend on kind of which field exactly we're discussing and what the specifics are. So difficult question, I think, for me to answer.
Yeah. And where is your place in cardiothoracic surgery? Do you see it?
As of now, planning on doing thoracic surgery and most interested in thoracic oncology. And so that's my thought so far. I think we'll see kind of as fellowship goes on, if I develop any specific niches or interests within that.
Great. Angelica, where is cardiothoracic going from your perspective?
Same thing. I'm going to guess at this just because everything is changing really quickly. The one thing that I'm seeing a lot of is how technology is being integrated into what we do, how we approach our patients, and then also what we're able to offer to them. So I think CT is just going to get more complex. I know that a lot of people think that, you know, CT is sort of dying down or going to be just a thing of the past. And I don't think that that's true. I'm actually seeing a lot of innovation when it comes to even just cancer treatment, right? At Davis, we're doing some really amazing single touch surgeries where we're able to diagnose smaller and smaller cancers and treat our patients and have them live happy, healthy lives afterwards. So just getting the technology that is becoming more complex and actually using it in patient care, I think that that's what's going to happen to personalize care. For cardiac surgery, a lot of our patients are getting older. We're seeing, you know, longer lives. People will have redo surgeries, so more complex surgeries. The need to have more complex skills is also going to be necessary. So I think that trainees right now should be being taught how to approach those types of patients, because we're already seeing them, you know, two-time redo sternotomies and all of that safely. We need to know how to do that.
And where do you see yourself in that future?
I've been told to keep an open mind. So I love the intensity of cardiac surgery and, you know, the focus that it requires. And I see the need there, like I said, for more Latina Spanish speaking cardiac surgeons. But I love the patient population of thoracic surgery, and lung cancer being the number one and number two killer of African-American and Latinos, and the lung cancer screening rates being the worst in California. I can't let that go either. My public health side cries when I hear those statistics, and they've just stuck to me. So I am undecided right now, and I hope to just get more experience and figure it out as I go.
Well, that's okay to be undecided. There's no reason why things have to be binary, and the world is the oyster for the two of you, who are prime example that our workforce and our specialty is in good hands. Dr. Lillian Tsai, independent fellow at Stanford University. Dr. Angelica Martin, integrated resident at University of California, Davis. Thank you very much for your time on Same Surgeon, Different Light. It's been a pleasure, and our audience is blessed. Thanks.
Thank you.
This has been Same Surgeon, Different Light, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please rate it 5 stars and let your friends, trainees, and colleagues know about it. On social media, you can use the hashtag #TheFaceOfCTSurgery. More information about the Society of Thoracic Surgeons is available online at sts.org.